From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. In the city of Baltese, at the end of the century before last, a hapless magician tries to conjure up a bouquet of lilies. But in the world of children's book author Kate DiCamillo, he accidentally conjures an elephant instead. It crashes through the ceiling of an opera house and cripples a noblewoman. And that's just the starting point for DiCamillo's latest book, The Magician's Elephant. Her previous books include the wildly popular Because of Winn-Dixie and The Tale of Despero. And Kate DiCamillo joins me here at the studios of NPR West in California. Thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for letting me come in.
And besides this elephant who's crashed through the ceiling, the main character here is a 10-year-old boy, Peter Augustus Duchene, an orphan.
Yes. Orphans are a good way to get a story started.
Because you have to figure out what
immediately you've got a conflict, so that's great. I like it that you called the magician hapless. I like that a lot.
That's how you see him?
Yeah, hapless but hopeful. He intends to conjure lilies, but he also wants to do something bigger and better.
And it was the character of the magician who came to you first, right?
Yes. This is one of those creepy things that writers say, that a magician appeared before me. And when I talk to kids and I say that, I always have to back up and go, not literally. You know, it was just this very clear vision of a magician. You could almost like smell his hair product.
What did it smell like?
Greasy, with, you know, a cheap cologne in it. And you could just tell that he was desperate and that he was tired of doing cheap tricks. He wanted to do real magic.
Does this happen often, that the characters appear to you and you smell their hair pomade?
No, not the smelling of hair products. That's probably a singular thing. But you're always waiting for that image or that character to show up, and you never know when it's going to happen, and it seems to be something out of your control.
He's a great little kid, Peter. He has a lot of faith in his own memory and his own belief. And it takes a while for it to come to the surface, but he knows what he believes.
Yes, and he dares to hope and to continue to hope, even though he does think occasionally that it might be easier to despair. But he doesn't stay there. He bounces back to hope.
And his hope in particular is
that he can find his sister, who he has become separated from, whom he has believed for quite some time to actually be dead, and who he then finds out is alive.
The notion of faith and memory and how sort of intertwined those are with children, those are pretty heavy things to be putting on pretty young, thin shoulders that you write about. But it seems to come up in your children's books time and again.
I do seem to have some thematic preoccupations, which I can't get away from. They keep on showing up again and again. And I think that children, being human beings, are as preoccupied with those big things as we are as adults. And I think it does them a huge disservice to assume that they are living in a world different than the one that we live in.
Well, that's an interesting notion right there, okay. that we maybe don't give kids enough credit for what they know, and maybe over-sanitize what we expect them to read and know.
And over-insist that they don't see what's right in front of them.
Can I tell you what I think my favorite little moment in the book is?
And I'm glad that you have any favorite moment at all. list all your favorite moments.
I have a few of them. But there's one, and I'm not sure quite why it grabs me, and I'm not frankly sure quite why it's in there, but it's...
Is that criticism?
No,
is that literary criticism?
I'll explain.
Okay.
There's a manservant who has a memory from when he was a child of his dog leaping across a river, and the dog, he would remember, in midair, would do a little flip, a little spin, just to express the joy of being able to jump across this river. And it's not central to the story. It doesn't...
It is central to the story in a way, though. Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, it triggers a memory. I mean, it triggers for him a memory, I guess.
And it becomes also this visual image of the impossible. That river that the small dog leaps across, she should not technically be able to do it. She's too small, and the river is too wide. But she not only does it, she does it with, and I don't know how you say this word, even though I put it in the book, Philip, F-I-L-I-P, a Philip of Joy. Is that how you say it? You're the one that's got more pronunciation skills than I do.
I think you got it.
So not only does she go across, but like you said, she does just a little unnecessary gesture to show that this impossible thing is easy for her. I think that's central to the whole story. The impossible can happen, and it can happen with grace and ease and joy.
And joy.
Yeah.
And a little bit of showing off.
Yeah, and a little bit of showing off, yeah.
Kate DiCarlo, what do you hate in children's books?
What do I hate in children's books? Wow, I feel like I'm really being set up now. I myself, as a child, hated it when somebody was writing a story to teach me a lesson. I was happy to take my facts from nonfiction, but I did not want somebody with an agenda telling me a story, and so I always kind of stay away from that as a storyteller myself. There can be, and there are, and there necessarily must be, lessons or meaning in a story, but they should not be the reason that you're telling the story. They should be just a part of the story, an organic part of it, and they should be as much a revelation to the writer as they are to the reader, because the more I go around and talk about this book, the more I learn about what's in it.
You learn about it after the fact.
I learn about it in talking to other people about it, yeah.
What do you learn?
Well, you know, it's so funny because so many people have told me absolutely emphatically that this is a book about hope. And then somebody, I just got an email from a friend the other day who said this is a book about grief. I think both of those things are true.
You know, and what do kids say?
Kids think it's pretty funny that an elephant would land in the lap of a noble woman.
Kids are smart.
Yeah, and I did have one kid say to me, this book begins with a cataclysmic event. Wow. Was there a cataclysmic event in your own life that made you write it? And I thought, wow, you don't want to mess around with kids because they'll put their finger right on it, you know.
And what did you tell him?
I said, sure, yeah. I said, you don't need to know what the cataclysmic event was, but it was born of my own cataclysmic event, yes.
How old a kid was this? The cataclysmic was in his
vocabulary. Isn't that a great word, yeah. Cataclysmic? He was 10.
Good for him.
Yeah.
Well, Kate DiCarlo, thanks so much for coming in. Great to talk to you.
Well, thank you for letting me be here.
Kate DiCarlo's latest book is The Magician's Elephant. To hear more of our conversation and get a look inside her writer's notebook, go to our website, npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Turns out it's not easy to take hockey to the desert. On the ice, the Phoenix Coyotes are pretty good. They've got the best record in their division of the National Hockey League. Off the ice, the team is a mess. The Coyotes are in bankruptcy court with their ownership and maybe even their future in Arizona in doubt. NPR's Ted Robbins explains.
Their home opener was a sellout. Granted, the team lowered ticket prices to fill the seats, but fan Chris Appling, who snagged one of the $15 tickets, says the gesture came at an important time.
If you have fans, the team will not leave. If you have nobody sitting in the seats, the fans here are the most important thing for this team instead.
Low attendance coupled with high costs have made the Phoenix Coyotes a financial disaster. The team lost $79 million over the last 2 years. In May, things went from bad to worse. The team, owned by Phoenix trucking tycoon Jerry Moyes, filed for bankruptcy. On the same day, Canadian tech tycoon Jim Balsillie offered to buy the team. Balsillie is co-CEO of the company that makes the BlackBerry. But the offer was contingent on a move to a more traditional hockey locale. The Hamilton, Ontario BlackBerries, Not if the Phoenix suburb of Glendale had anything to say about it. Glendale built a $180 million arena, and having seen sports teams in other cities leave for greener pastures, tacked on a $550 million penalty if the team moved before its 30-year lease was up. Pepperdine University professor Dean Boehm is an expert on sports financing. He says bankruptcy was a power play by Moyes to sell the team to Balsillie.
The bankruptcy was a way of circumventing the contractual obligations that the team had to Glendale and maybe even to the NHL.
It worried professional sports so much that the NFL, the NBA, and Major League Baseball joined with the NHL in court to oppose the sale to Balsillie. Last month, Judge Redfield Baum rejected Balsillie's bid. NHL Vice President Frank Brown called the decision precedent-setting.
It affirmed the essential right of not only our sports league, but any major professional sports league to determine the complement of ownership and the location of the franchises.
There's no guarantee that a court-approved buyer won't move the team, but a number of current potential buyers say they won't. One of the leading contenders is another Canadian company called Ice Edge. Ice Edge executive Daryl Jones thinks the Coyotes can make money in Phoenix.
4.5 million people. Yeah, it doesn't take too many hockey fans of that 4.5 million to make the team succeed.
Standing in the crowded arena on opening night, the NHL's Frank Brown says now at least there's the opportunity to try.
That noise. Compare that to the silence that would have happened if the court hadn't ruled the way it did.
The NHL hopes a new owner for the team is approved soon, an owner who can concentrate on creating a solvent Phoenix Coyotes team and a winning one. Ted Robbins, NPR News.
Okay, so San Francisco may be on the cutting edge of recycling food waste in this country. In Asia, there are countries where that's nothing new. But those efforts are a rare bright spot in a new book called Waste, Uncovering the Global Food Scandal. Author Tristram Stewart makes the case that much of the developed world is careless in the way it produces and consumes food, tossing vast quantities from fields of imperfect produce to the lettuce you left in the fridge a little too long. Stewart argues there is a more responsible approach.
In the United States, under 3% of municipal food waste, so that's the food scraps that go into people's garbage cans, actually gets recycled. If you go to a place like South Korea, the exact reverse is the case. It's about 3% that doesn't get recycled. The rest is recycled through composting and very largely and very sensibly through feeding that food waste to livestock. And that's something that I found really interesting. In Japan, Taiwan and South Korea, the government has, in a matter of years, put a lot of energy behind recycling food waste as livestock feed. It's environmentally friendly. It provides cheap livestock feed for the farmers in those parts of the world. And it avoids sending food waste to landfill. And that's one of the really key things, because when food waste goes to landfill, it decomposes. In the absence of oxygen, that produces methane. And methane is more powerful as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide.
Methane, as we say it here, methane, in case somebody is not sort of picking up on that. But the reality, of course, is enormous waste. And the picture on the cover of your book, Waste, is quite stunning. A sea of tomatoes. Tell us where that is and what that is.
Well, that's in Tenerife, but really what we're looking at is just one snapshot of an attitude to food which prevails in rich countries throughout the world. When I researched this book, I started on farms, I went down through manufacturers, through retailers, restaurants, and into people's homes. And it's when you tot up the waste that happens at every level in the food supply chain that the really shocking figures come out. I mean, retailers throw out food on a daily basis, and you open up their bins around the back of their stores, and it looks like someone has tipped a supermarket shelf into the dumpster. And I, for the research in the book, and also for the last several years, have been taking food out of those bins not because I think it's wrong to buy food in supermarkets, but simply to make the point that the food shouldn't be being put there in the first place. There are lots of ways in which retailers can avoid wasting food. They can reduce the price of stock before it reaches its expiry date. They can avoid, most importantly, overstocking in the first place. And, at the very least, they can donate surplus to charities before it passes its expiry date.
Well, you just said you take food that's been thrown away, and I gather that you actually live off of some of this food. It's freeganism is what it is.
That's a term that people use, and I don't mind the label as long as it's made clear that I'm doing it for one reason and one reason only, to make a point that the food shouldn't be being put in the bin in the first place. These stores will actually save money by giving the food away, because they won't have to pay for the disposal costs. Instead, of charity will come and take it off their hands for free. They also get tax breaks in the United States. That is the kind of very obvious, easy, implementable, realistic solution that I'm advocating in my book. We have the solutions. We know how to do it. We just need to do it more effectively and across the board.
Author Tristram Stewart, his new book is called Waste.
Starting today in San Francisco, it is illegal to toss food scraps in your garbage can. Those scraps now have to go in a special food recycling bin. This is the first program of its kind in the nation, and so far it's a mandate that San Franciscans seem to appreciate. David Gorn reports.
Everyone who has ever lived in an apartment knows about this place. Deep in the basement, smelly and dark, the place where the garbage goes. In your apartment, you open the door to your garbage chute, and the garbage bag tumbles down past many floors till it splats into the pile in the basement. This is the garbage room of the Cathedral Hill Plaza apartments in San Francisco, but there's a big difference about this basement room.
It doesn't smell so bad. Our trash room doesn't stink like it used to.
That's because none of the wet garbage, the food waste, goes down here anymore, says Linda Corso, the apartment manager. Instead, food scraps go into sealed compost bins that get picked up by the city. The program, Corso says, has trimmed the building's garbage costs significantly.
We used to have two bins picked up every day, and now we have one bin picked up every day. So we've cut that in half.
In getting ready for implementation of the law, residents throughout the city have received their food recycling bins, and they've already put them to use. So much so that garbage officials here have been stunned and heartened by the tons and tons of food waste that's already streaming in.
We're in San Francisco at the Organics Annex. This is where the trucks that pick up the food scraps from your curbside travel to the south of the city. This is the heart of the operation.
Jared Blumenfeld is the city's environmental officer. He says the Organics Annex is already processing about half of all of the city's food waste, more than 500 tons of it a day.
You see it dumping right now, a lot of food, a lot of lettuce, tomatoes, old apples, rotten cabbages. You kind of get a vivid picture of what's being thrown away.
San Francisco turns all of that food refuse into compost, which is then sold to Bay Area farms and vineyards. This is the latest effort in one of the most aggressive recycling campaigns in the nation. San Francisco currently keeps 72% of its garbage stream out of the landfill by recycling cans, bottles, construction material, cooking oil. Blumenfeld says even though the program officially launches today, he's not surprised by how many people are already fully participating.
We hear a lot about climate change and what we can do and should do and stuff that's happening in Congress, but people want to know what they can practically do every single day. And composting their food scraps is probably the single most effective thing that you could do as a citizen in the United States today.
Here's the thing, Blumenfeld says. Separating out the food scraps is really just diverting the smelly stuff to a different place. It doesn't cost much, he says. It's really a simple logistical thing.
This is not rocket science. This is putting some food scraps in a different pile and then turning it into compost. If we can't do that, I really worry about our ability to do some of those more complex things.
The city can fine people for non-compliance, but officials say they're unlikely to use that power, except in extreme cases. And the city's ultimate and pretty lofty goal, according to Blumenfeld, is to get to zero waste, meaning no garbage at all going into the landfill, by the year 2020. For NPR News, I'm David Gorn.
Now to Wall Street. Those student loans may be a small fortune to recent college grads, but the numbers are small change compared to the multi-million dollar bonuses that are returning to Wall Street. Last week, investment bank Goldman Sachs reported surging profits, and by the end of the year, analysts report, the firm could distribute as much as $23 billion in bonuses for 2009. That figure would represent twice as much as the firm set aside for bonuses in 2008. And that number is all the more striking because it comes just a year after taxpayers stepped in to stabilize Goldman and the other big banks with billions of dollars in bailout money. On the Sunday morning talk shows, lawmakers and White House officials took note and criticized the bonuses.
The bonus is an issue is because people are frustrated that Wall Street is back to a behavior, having just basically 4 months ago been in a different situation, and the only way they got out of it is through the good graces of the government and the taxpayers.
I think what they need to understand is on the same day that you saw stories about these bonuses, you saw a story about how wages are at a 19-year low.
These firms on Wall Street need to understand that what they're doing by providing these bonuses, particularly when they receive so much federal money, is an outrage in the country.
Wall Street firms have said that they need these bonuses for good performance in order to keep their best employees on board. So what about it? Are these bonuses just another Wall Street greed fest or a necessary tool to keep the strong players on the job? To talk about this, we called Sylvia Maxfield. She's Associate Professor of Management at Simmons College in Boston. She's also a former Senior Sovereign Analyst at Lehman Brothers. Also with us, Emmy Award-winning journalist Valerie Coleman Morris. She's the host of With the Family in Mind, a CBS Network radio program about money management. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Sylvia, $23 billion, as we said, almost twice the bonus money set aside by Goldman Sachs just last year in 2008. What's the justification? Are the bonuses straight arithmetic? A percentage of profits are automatically distributed to the employees? Is it contractual? Is it just custom? How does it work?
Well, it's arithmetic. So they're setting aside 43% of net revenues. So that's everything that they've earned this year minus their costs. And they say that that is a lower percentage than they have set aside at times in the past.
And so does everyone participate in the bonus pool? For example, secretaries, do they get part of the bonus pool?
Everyone participates, although the really large bonuses are going to go to the folks who were at the center of the money-making operations for Goldman. So senior folks and, in this case, folks who were on the trading floor, which is where most of the revenue came.
You can understand where the outrage is coming from, obviously, from the standpoint of just how it feels sitting, you know, out there in the public reading the papers. But from your standpoint as a person who both worked on Wall Street and now studies it, is this – and I obviously think that there's kind of a political or moral judgment involved here, but is this justifiable?
Well, it's been the practice for many, many years to award most of your compensation in terms of bonuses in the financial sector. But what we've seen since 1980 is a huge uptick in the difference between financial sector wages and overall wages. And I think that's where the outrage comes. And that's been because the sector's grown a lot and it's been very profitable, and the practice is you want to keep your star employees, you got to pay them a big bonus. Doesn't feel very good to those of us who haven't seen a raise in a couple years or are seeing our benefits cut away or have been looking for a job for a year.
Valerie, what's your reaction as a person who works primarily with individuals, who's working primarily to enhance financial literacy? How common is this as a wage structure for people to get most of their compensation in the form of bonuses or deferred compensation or stock? And how does it strike you?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, I think that we should look at what bonuses were really meant to do. I don't believe they were ever meant to be a guarantee. I think they were kind of the carrot, and they were based on performance. And so the problem with Wall Street's bonuses now in the current environment, as far as I see it, is that people are getting paid anyway. You know, they get paid for selling stock. They get paid for the transaction. They actually get paid even if you lose money. So where's the risk that's involved in their job? And because bonuses were used to motivate performance, which I certainly think is good, but it was for performance that falls to the bottom line, now they really are getting paid irrespective of circumstances, and I think that is what is concerning and has angered Main Street.
If it's a percentage of profit, though, if it's a percentage of profit, couldn't you make an argument that it is based on performance?
Oh, I think that in many places it is based on performance, but we're talking about what's the public's reaction to it. And I think that this understandably generates a controversy. I think it generates anger. The reality is we live in a capitalist society. I believe in it, and I think that's good. And compensation should be based on long-term results, not on short-term speculation. When properly used, bonuses are a great thing. Sadly, right now, I think the average person says, we're not getting ours. Why are they getting theirs? And it's kind of like, what do you mean, bonuses after a bailout? Even though Goldman has paid their $10 billion back to the government.
That was what I was going to ask. So there is the government cannot intervene in this bonus structure, if I have this right. Valerie, because Goldman has paid back the money that was originally lent to it by the government?
Goldman, I understand, paid back the $10 billion government bailout plus dividends. And then Goldman had a spectacular third quarter. I mean, more than $3 billion. So in large part, the good performance of Goldman is getting lost in this story of Wall Street bonuses and how the public is reacting to it.
If you're just joining us, I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with financial journalist Valerie Coleman Morris and Sylvia Maxfield, associate professor of management at Simmons College. We're talking about the bonuses on Wall Street. They are back, they are large, and they are attracting attention. We're talking about whether these are justified or not. Sylvia, one of the arguments is that this is a way to keep key players on the job. But given the contraction on Wall Street, with what, three of the five major firms are now no longer existing, is that really true?
I think that we'll see that practice erode, and there is a discussion about changing the structure. For example, having a clawback, which means if the performance doesn't keep up for some period of time, 2-3 years, that the individual who was paid the bonus would actually have to pay back a portion of it. So I do think we're going to see some changes. We have to see some changes because public sentiment is so negative.
I was going to ask you that. Why do you think there is some move afoot to change compensation? But why? Given, as we mentioned, that the actual lever no longer exists with this particular firm. Where is the impetus for change?
Because we're going to see increased regulation of the financial industry in general coming out of Congress. And we've been seeing lots and lots of hearings and discussion and debate. You know, Goldman made this money operating essentially as a hedge fund. And there's a huge discussion out there in Congress and in the political world about further regulation of hedge funds. And hedge funds have been pushing back. So we've seen incredible deregulation of the financial industry in the United States since 1980. And we're going to see that pendulum swing back. And part of that may be some laws that actually guide what these firms can do broadly. The government's not going to get involved in individual decisions. But I do think that practice will change either because of the fear of regulation or because actually regulation does get passed into law.
And finally, Valerie, what about those regulations that the administration is contemplating that would enhance protections for consumers and transparency and so forth? How likely do you think that is?
I am hoping, and I'm yielding to more of the expert who teaches economics, Sylvia, and I think that what her statements that she just made are very valid. My concern is regarding the argument that Goldman says it needs to pay these large sums to retain its best people or they're going to risk losing them to rivals. You know, with this money that's been set aside for compensation and bonuses, the Times says that that's around $700,000 on average for many of the company's 31,000 plus employees. Here's the thing for me. I think the whole idea of we've got to pay them or we lose them is a smokescreen of just trying to keep things the way they are. I think it's disingenuous. Look at outside opportunities right now. They are fewer for everyone. And if you're getting a $700,000 bonus and you're making a $225,000 salary on average, I don't think you're going to walk away from the job. I don't think there is this additional risk that if you don't pay them a lot, you're going to lose your biggest and your brightest. I don't think it's true.
And Sylvia, what about you very briefly? True? Not true?
You know, I think that the industry overfired, and so there is some hiring going on. And the bottom line is, for those top traders who are making huge sums of money on a week-to-week basis, they can leave. They will be snapped up in a minute by any of the other top firms if they let it be known that they're not happy with their seat.
Well, we'll see.
So at the very high end, that argument holds.
Well, we'll see. Sylvia Maxfield is Associate Professor of Management at Simmons College. She joined us from member station WGBH in Boston. Valerie Coleman Morris is an award-winning financial journalist and the host of With the Family in Mind, a CBS Network radio program about money management. And she joined us on the phone from Tucson, Arizona. Ladies, thank you both so much.
Thanks, Michelle. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Michelle.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. When media mogul Rupert Murdoch paid nearly $600 million to buy MySpace back in 2005, MySpace was the biggest thing in social networking. Now Facebook is taking over. Facebook has an estimated 95 million visitors in the U.S., compared with 65 million for MySpace. NPR's Laura Seidel reports that the numbers don't tell the whole story about the differences in social networking.
Ask the high school students out in front of this elite private school in San Francisco, and they'll tell you, MySpace is just so last year.
We use Facebook.
Yeah.
Everybody here uses Facebook.
We made the transition.
No one uses
Facebook
MySpace.
Is very in. MySpace is very out.
Ali Pacheco and Kay Gamble, both 17, and 16-year-old Olivia Block can list a lot of reasons they left MySpace and went to Facebook.
And more high class.
Well, and by high class, I think she means organized. I don't know. With MySpace, there's just a lot of clutter.
The MySpace clutter seems to symbolize something more to these kids. About half a dozen students standing around 16-year-old Nico Kurt all nod as he explains.
It seems trashy to me. I mean, like, it's starting to be that, like, yeah, it's like the only people that actually use it are, like, trashy people.
Well, there are millions of those trashy people on MySpace. And some of them are on the other side of the city, taking an art class at a community gallery called Southern Exposure. Most of these kids here come from lower-income families, and they are Latino. And they have their own ideas about who uses which social networks.
I have friends who are white people friends, and then they're mostly on Facebook, so that's why I use Facebook. And I don't know, I guess my brown people are on MySpace.
That's 19-year-old Diego Luna. He and 16-year-old Benito Rodriguez say they have both Facebook and MySpace accounts.
Not to be racist or anything, but yeah, there's more white kids in Facebook.
Dana Boyd has heard a lot of conversations just like this one. She's a social media researcher for Microsoft who's been talking to teens all over the country. She thinks the online social world is dividing up like the real world into neighborhoods.
The fact is that young people, and for the most part adults as well, don't really interact online with strangers. They talk to people they already know. And when you have environments in which people are divided by race, they're divided by class, they're divided by lifestyle, well, when they go online, those are also who they're going to interact with.
Boyd thinks one of the reasons that so many business analysts are writing off MySpace is because they don't belong to the social groups that use it.
Millions of daily users are still logging in, and it's really interesting how many people in very privileged environments simply know not a single one of them.
Boyd believes MySpace is actually in a great place to bring in advertising dollars. She says low-income people are more likely to click on ads.
People who click don't necessarily buy.
That's Ray Valdez, an analyst with Gartner who follows social network sites.
You don't want to brand yourself as the network for low-income Hispanics or low-income, you know, some other segment.
But MySpace also does have a very strong user base among artists who are drawn to its music applications and its tools for decorating homepages. Charlene Lee of Altimeter Group says if MySpace wants to compete, it's going to have to evolve.
MySpace has done such a good job of serving their core audience. The difference is, I think, people like Facebook, the reason why they have not sort of peaked and sort of fallen off is that they have not remained still.
And the kids at that private school don't have any particular loyalty to Facebook. Nico Kurt thinks it's just a fad.
Teenager generations always like to go from one thing to another, and Facebook is that thing. But I think it's going downhill.
You think Facebook's going down too?
I think there's going to be a new cool thing sooner or later.
And in case anyone is thinking maybe the next cool thing is Twitter, Well, Kurt says Twitter is for old people. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
And you can let us know whether you prefer Facebook or MySpace, or tell us your opinions about anything else by joining our online community at npr.org.